Hi there and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And what I want to talk about in this episode is the continuation of the First World War in the Baltic states after the armistice in 1918. And this war, this new theatre of war, really opens up between three parties, between the new nation, the new national governments of the Baltic states themselves, the Red Army, and also what remained of the Kaiser Army, the German Kaiser Army, at the end of the war, which took on a fascinating new lease of life with the guidance and say-so of the British. There's a lot of study done at the moment into the successor conflicts from the First World War, which, if you run a line really from Finland all the way down to Syria, there are endless conflicts in the 5 years that follow 1918. Robert Gerwath, whose book The Vanquished I've recently been reading, one of the points that he makes is that as far as our historiography is concerned here in Great Britain or in France or in Germany or in the USA, the armistice that ended the First World War in 1918 really should be seen as an armistice between the great powers. It was a great power ceasefire. Nationalist wars and civil wars, revolutionary wars, and the kind of revanchist wars of nations like Turkey and Greece continue throughout this period and are extremely bloody, and within them are echoes of the future. A great many of these wars are waged primarily against civilians. They feature genocidal acts such as the Armenian genocide and the burning of the city of Smyrna. And they are a kind of an indication as to what will happen with conflict, not just in the Second World War, but throughout the rest of the 20th century, as these powers of nation and revolution are unleashed and set on one another. So, after the hostilities had finished on the 11th of November 1918, 2 days later, the Red Army, with support from Latvian Bolsheviks, marched into the western borders of the former Tsarist Empire, and their plan was to seize territory that had been surrendered by Germany, which Germany had annexed as a result of the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk in March 1918. The revolutions that were happening across Central Europe in Vienna and Budapest and Berlin and in Munich made Lenin think that possibly, just possibly, the dream of exporting the revolution might still be alive. There was every evidence to suggest that this was unlikely to happen, but Lenin knew that if Bolshevism was to survive at all, it needed to leave Russia's borders and make it to the West. Otherwise, it would exist in some kind of zombie form within Russia without the kind of necessary levels of industry and education to sustain it. Mutinous German soldiers were leaving their garrisons and marching back to Germany, and the national armies that faced the Red Army were in the Baltic states were particularly weak. The Red Army quickly occupied Estonia and Latvia and seized Riga on January the 3rd, 1919. And they crushed Vilnius in Lithuania 5 days later. Lenin was quick to bring revolutionary principles to these conquered states. And when the Soviets in Red Army invaded Poland in 1920, they were trying to apply similar practices. The property of the middle classes was expropriated, was stolen, was taken in either by Red Army soldiers or redistributed to local peasants. A revolutionary government in Estonia was established in the city of Narva, which began to nationalise land. And the policies that had been implemented or had been started to be implemented into Russia to manage the food supply, what we roughly call war communism, are also introduced into the Baltic states. And when the starving peasantry protest, they are met with brute force and violence. The Baltic republics, Baltic Soviet republics, quickly faced a violent counter-revolution. An organisation, the Estonian People's Force, was overthrew the Estonian Soviet Republic, and the Latvian and Lithuanian Soviet Republics were overthrown with some external help. The problems that the Western Allies were faced with in this part of the world were immense. Not only did communism appear to be spreading, but the British and the French, preoccupied with the aftermath of the war, were unable and indeed unwilling to launch a new war in the Baltic. The Allied invasion of Russia, which if initially had happened in order to prevent Germany during 1918 from capitalizing on territory and infrastructure that the Red Army had now abandoned, or that the Tsarist government, which had now ceased to exist, had retreated from. This became, obviously, in the imagination of Churchill, an anti-communist crusade. But it was very controversial. The British and the French, even if they weren't ardent supporters of Lenin, didn't wish to see a new theatre in war open up. They wanted to see an end to hostilities, and they didn't want to see Britain and France going to war in Russia in earnest. So sending armies to the Baltics was politically untenable. However, the new German government, after the German Revolution, under Friedrich Ebert, was approached by the Western Allies on the understanding that a cooperative Germany might not do too badly at the Paris Peace Conference, though this obviously wasn't the case at all. The Allies approach Friedrich Ebert and ask him whether he can delay the withdrawal of troops from the Baltics, as it is not in the interests of the British or the French or the new democratic Germany to see them fall to communism. Before the fall of Riga on the 29th of December 1918, the Latvian government, with the help of Britain, called for the creation of a Baltic German anti-communist army that would defend the region from the new Soviet regime. This force, when it emerged, was composed of ethnic German minorities from the Baltic states, along with reinforcements from Germany. The German 8th Army, which was still present in the Baltics, and volunteers formed the Iron Division, which was a group of about 16,000 soldiers. The division was led by an officer, Major General Josef Bischoff, who was cut his teeth in the world of German imperialism before the First World War in Africa, where he participated in the genocide against the Herero and the Nama peoples between 1904 and 1906 in what's now Namibia, or was then German West Africa. And he fought on nearly every front in the Great War. Now, there is a fascinating history of the origins of Nazism and German fascism in general in the Baltic states. The figures such as Alfred Rosenberg, supposedly the theorist and kind of philosopher of Nazism, though one can't imagine a great deal of robust philosophical thought going into it, had been an emigre from Tallinn in Estonia, where he'd been born in 1893. And he had fled across the border into Germany after having fought part of a kind of a guerrilla war against the communists in the Baltic states. And there was this there was a surprising number of Nazis who had either been German soldiers stationed in the Baltics fighting a rearguard action against the spread of communism, or they'd been ethnic Germans who had lived there all their lives and returned to the Reich once the revolution had happened. And it gives you important clues here as to where the flow of anti-communism comes from in Nazi thought. There are all sorts of indicators that this kind of conflict had enabled people like Rosenberg to kind of really kind of cut their teeth in fighting communism from at an early point. The Latvian government offered German soldiers who were facing very poor prospects on their return home to the Reich the vision of being able to settle in Latvia and farm the land, to kind of colonise the land. This would be part of the reward for fighting against the communists. This is a very attractive deal. And certainly it brought a number of adventurers and mercenaries and those who were looking to do something now that the Great War was over, through to the east to fight against communism. Many simply just wished to continue the war. They were able to engage in the kinds of fighting now that made sense to them. These were men who perhaps weren't going to settle easily back into civilian life and enjoyed the camaraderie, violence.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And discipline, and to some extent, I guess, chaos as well, that war brought. And they use the term Freikorps. The Freikorps was a term originally used during the anti-Napoleonic wars from 1813 to 1815, and it was used by the German volunteers who fought following the Battle of Jena, where Prussia was humiliated by Napoleon. And it was these Freikorps who made a significant contribution to the downfall of Napoleon in the end. So they were men who looked to the past in order to find kind of inspiration in the most desperately dire times for Germany. And they thought that the campaign in the Baltics would be an opportunity to rekindle some of the martial spirit that might lead to the overturn eventually of whatever treaty was going to be imposed on them. And again, here are the ideas that are integral eventually to Nazism later on, these little seeds of thought and sentiment and emotion. When the Freikorps arrived in the Baltics to protect the region, the Iron Division came under of Rüdiger von Goltz, who was a general who had defeated the communists during the Finnish Civil War in early 1918, and the German forces, which were about 40,000 strong, began very quickly to take on the Bolsheviks. The offensive in Latvia focused on the capture of the most ethnically German towns, Geldingen, Vindel and Mittau. And from here, the Bolsheviks were repelled. If you take any, even a cursory glance at the problems of the Red Army initially and the kind of the poor discipline and training and equipment and motivation of Red Army soldiers, it's hardly difficult to see why it is they were no match for men who'd been fighting for the best part of 4 years on a variety of fronts. However, the objective was the seizure of Latvia's capital, Riga. The campaign in Latvia is really quite different than it had been on the Western Front. At least on the Western Front, there had been clearly marked boundaries, there had been identifiable enemies, but in the Baltic states and in Latvia, there was chaos. Not only did Russians and Latvians and even some former German POWs fight on the side of the Bolsheviks, often in improvised uniforms or disguised as civilians, which gave the Germans the sense that they were fighting a guerrilla warfare, which the German army has always fought with immense violence, cruelty and brutality, you know, the execution of prisoners and all that kind of thing. But in addition to that, as I said previously, the First World War had been mainly a war fought between armed combatants. This successor war in the Baltics, in Latvia, was fought mainly against civilians. Rudolf Höss, who would later become the commander of commandant of Auschwitz, wrote in his memoirs, the ones he wrote before he was hanged, the battles in the Baltic states were more brutal and vicious than anything I had experienced before. There was hardly a front line. The enemy was everywhere. Wherever the opposing forces collided, there was slaughter until nobody was left. So you have a unmistakable war of annihilation here. This account was given in 1947, just before Höss was executed, and in some ways Höss is trying to offer mitigation in the book as to why he behaved as he did, but there is perhaps something to be said for the fact that a great many people like Höss had initially experienced these kind of brutalizing experiences too. The campaign in the Baltic was characterized by extraordinary violence and the targeting of civilians who were thought to have been Bolshevik sympathizers. For example, Robert Gerwith writes, "In Mittau alone, Freikorps soldiers executed some 500 Latvian civilians accused of aiding and abetting the Bolsheviks. A further 325 were killed in the towns of Tukum and Juniminda. Although violence against civilians had certainly not been uncommon over the preceding 4 years, notably on the Eastern Front, it had remained exceptional, at least within the general context of a major war between uniformed combatants. After 1918, the targeting of suspect civilians by troops, no longer bound by conventional military laws and regulations, became the norm." And of course, as with all guerrilla wars of the 20th century, the native population who were associated with guerrillas, bandits and insurgents become the front line of attacks and violence as a direct result. There were stories that German soldiers told of their comrades being found in the bushes, in hanging from trees, their bodies mutilated, and as a result, nearby civilians would then be murdered by German soldiers. This kind of strange coalition between German volunteer forces and the Latvian government was put under great strain by Freikorps violence against Latvian civilians, and it falls apart completely once the objective of the campaign, the expulsion of the Red Army, had been achieved. There was no need to have these violent thugs of the Freikorps around anymore. The Latvian People's Council declared independence from Russia in November 1918. However, Karlis Ulmanis, who was the US-educated strongman of the council, thought that German soldiers might become Latvian land labourers, peasants and journeymen, after the Red Army had been kicked out. The German general, Goltz, however, had other plans, and when Ulmanis' government asked for the withdrawal of the German troops, the Germans staged a coup. On the 16th of April 1919, the Freikorps soldiers replaced the government with a puppet regime, which was run by Pastor Andreas Niedra, who it was clear was open to furthering German interests. This coup led to the Western Allies to demand the immediate return of Freikorps soldiers to Germany. In their eyes, the Freikorps was evidence that Germany had done a number on the Western Allies. The Western Allies, who were still able to choke Germany using the Royal Navy and to starve Germany using the Royal Navy, were able to put immense pressure on Germany. The only reason why they had wanted the Freikorps in the Baltic states initially to begin with was to stop Russia. And now the seizure of the Baltic states, the creation of a puppet government, looked rather like Germany was trying to still annex territory in the east, something that was unconscionable whilst the Paris Peace Conference was going on and whilst there was the Treaty of Versailles was being decided. Ebert's government had the perfect response. They simply told the British and the French that if they wanted the Red Army back on Germany's borders, they could have that in an instant if the Freikorps withdrawn. Either that or perhaps they could send their own troops to police the Baltic states. In May 1919, Germany seized Riga with immense violence and brutality, and the mass murder of civilians who they thought had been acting as snipers and saboteurs. And obviously, along with this came a great deal of violence against women and sexual violence. The fly in the ointment, of course, in this period of time was the decision to sign the Treaty of Versailles by the Weimar government. Whilst German soldiers were still fighting and dying in the Baltic states and were still believing themselves to be able to militarily advance the interests of Germany, they saw civilian politicians in Germany or in France at the time signing away Germany's future as they saw it. The 14,000 troops in Latvia joined forces with the White Russian Army of the West, which was commanded by Colonel Pavel Bermontavlov. Several months down the line, German volunteers were continuing to fight against Latvians and also the Red Army. They had been deprived of any material support from Berlin. The Freikorps troops increasingly lived off the land and foraged and stole, as armies of occupation tend to do, even though they were living off an already starving population. And this led in turn to an increasing desire by Latvians to fight to force the Germans out and to force also the Red Army out too. And the part of the kind of the Latvian national movement and sort of national myth is forged in this time, as they saw themselves as a reaction to both German and Soviet imperialism. Hungry German soldiers, and it was Hungary eventually that defeated the Germans in the Baltics as they retreated, would loot and destroy farms. And the ragtag remnants of the Freikorps returned to Germany in late 1919, and it was many of those men who went on to form the groups that led to waves of assassinations across Germany in the early 1920s, particularly of Versailles politicians such as Philipp Scheidemann. I've gone on far too long, so I hope you found that enjoyable and interesting, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. If you can offer some support via Patreon, that'd be very kind, and I look forward to speaking to you soon. All the best, bye-bye.